Came up, that's all me. Stay true, that's all me. No help, that's all me. All me for real.
Money on my mind, you should think the same. J's on, pink and ring. Dogging these hoes, I need quarantine. In the same league, we don't bow the same.
Hey, welcome to Crack Podcast number 7, in which we are going to talk about the most popular lie in America. One lie that Americans just love to tell over and over again. Could think of it as a cultural bias, but that probably doesn't do it justice. I think cultural bias is one of those things that kind of got a weird reputation in the 90s due to just how goofy everything was and how overused it was. It's sort of the intellectual equivalent of rappers who can dance. But a cultural bias can also be like a real conspiracy theory, one of those things that once you hear it, you start to see it everywhere. For instance, if you read the site, you know, I love to talk about the bias in the 80s popular culture that wanted to believe that racism was over. That was one of those biases that once you notice it, every depiction of race from the 80s sort of fits into that mold. We go from the Jeffersons moving on up in the 70s to the Huxtables having arrived. You've got Rocky going from fighting Apollo Creed to befriending him and eventually avenging his death. And I'm going to be talking about a cultural bias with Jason Pargin, who writes on the site as David Wong, one of our most popular writers. You might remember him from a couple of episodes back when we talked about how paranoid we are about the NSA. But we're going to talk about a cultural bias that's sort of like the 80s one that I just mentioned, but more widespread. It's not just the 80s. It goes all the way back, man. It's one of those things that once I had it in my head, I just couldn't stop noticing it. Sort of like a conspiracy theory that creates a single explanation that sort of threads through all of American pop culture and history. The other weird thing about this bias that we're going to be talking about today is how specific it is. The closest thing I can compare it to is the three-act structure of movies. When I started writing and found out that every movie I had ever seen fits into this neat three-act structure, I kind of couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that the movie industry would have the balls to follow the exact same roadmap for every single movie. And I'd seen a lot of movies by that point. I figured I would have noticed it. And then I watched Jaws again, something you may not know about me. I watched Jaws 130 times before my 6th birthday. Being into Jaws was sort of my thing because I was not a very bright child, but I watched it again and every single scene followed this very specific roadmap down to the minute, the point where this is supposed to happen, the plot reversal is supposed to happen. That happened at the exact midpoint in terms of the running time. And that is sort of how concrete the rules in our brain are when it comes to what a story should do. And in today's episode, we're going to be talking about one story, one single lie that we graft onto the truth over and over again. It's like 99% of our creation myths, the stories we make up or embellish about where stuff came from, fit into that same weirdly specific mold. But before we get to what that mold is, I want to cover one last leftover true story from last episode. If you didn't listen to it, we talked about real world origin stories. You know, not superheroes in comic books, but true stories that created the world as we know it. You know, we talked about how the letters on the keyboard you use every day came to be arranged that way, how Lucille Ball accidentally invented Star Trek, believe it or not, and how Native Americans invented way more of America than you think. But Michael and I also talked about one of the best true stories that I've ever heard, and we've heard a lot of stories since launching Cracked in 2006. It's the origin of a painter,
Domenico Theotocopoulos,
and a bunch of painters,
otherwise known as El Greco.
Some of the most groundbreaking painters in history, really.
I like the idea that there's a famous painter and people are like, oh, this guy's good, what's his name? Domenico Theotocopoulos, no, where is he from? Greece? The Greek. He's the Greek. So this guy was famous for painting these really elongated figures, and it was a big deal at the time because it was a time where you didn't really stretch people out and make them all Picasso. And it became his trademark. And post-mortem, people have come to believe, oh, he had a deformed iris. He often said, I paint what I see. That was his canned response to, why do your paintings look like that? I paint what I see. And everyone was like, oh, deep. Ooh, he's dark. No, he literally, everything was elongated. He needed contact lenses. And it turns out, a bunch of painters. The two biggies I found were Monet and Degas. The whole Impressionist movement exists because glasses technology didn't exist yet.
Right.
Monet does more and more and more vague, blurry paintings, gets more and more famous and known for that as his eyesight is
just
failing.
Just degenerates.
Degas the same does these paintings and statues where he does crazy, oh, it's a ballerina, but it's just like a swoop of motion because he couldn't see shit. That's what he saw.
It's like the origin story that you would come up for if you were writing a comic book for these painters.
Very superhero-esque, actually, those guys.
Yeah, exactly. Like they were bitten by a spider.
Right.
The version of that for
it is. It's like this one thing happened to them, and forevermore he was Picasso. It really is that way.
Great story, right? Seems like the sort of thing we would be telling each other, right? Spider-Man, but true, and we just don't bother because our brains will only accept someone's origin story if it's shaped in a certain way. So that particular lie that we return to over and over again, that we demand our origin stories be shaped like, that is what I talked to David Wong about. Some quick context for something you're going to hear me mention up top. We were having a great conversation for like 20 minutes when I realized I hadn't pressed record on the recording device. It was a crushing blow. Everyone told me that I should give up on the interview, that it was over for me. But against all odds, we pressed on. I pushed record, and here's what happened next.
Plus years of selling Johnson & Johnson. I started out as a baby face monster. No wonder it's diaper rash on my conscience. My teeth and ring was numb by that nonsense.
All right, we just did 15 minutes and I didn't have it recording. So we're going to get back into the conversation with David Wong, Jason Pargin, executive editor at crack.com. Jason, you want to introduce yourself?
Yes, he said I am the executive editor. For those of you who don't know Crack or know what those job titles mean, basically Jack is my boss, so he's like the Captain Jean-Luc Picard of our Enterprise, and I'm like the Luke Skywalker.
And we are talking about origin stories.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you want to pick up with your theory on the Jewish bankers that
right.
Are secretly running the world governments, or where, how much of that you wanted to just go ahead and leave off on the second.
Yeah, so we've looked at a bunch of origin stories, and it seems like the ones that get remembered are the ones where people come from nothing. They're rags to riches stories where people have to do it all on their own. You had kind of noticed in some pretty prominent people's origin stories of themselves and how they gained success.
Yeah, and again, when we talk about origin stories, like that's a term that's used in comic books, but every famous person has that. Like if you went to grade school in America, you know Abraham Lincoln's origin story, which is he grew up in a log cabin and had nothing and, you know, did his schoolwork on a dirt floor and then became a politician and whatever, saved America. Bill Gates started Microsoft in his garage, dropped out of college to start it, you know, took a big risk. And in each of these stories, it leaves out a really specific plot point that is always there if you look close enough, which is the point where they met, each of these people met a prominent, often wealthy, established person who help them. That element of meeting the right people and impressing them is not considered inspirational enough to include, in most cases, Henry Ford, the guy who, you know, not only started Ford Motor Company, but kind of invented the modern world as it looks today, because he, you know, perfected the assembly line, created a world where everyone could own an automobile. But he didn't start that in his garage. He was working as an engineer on helping to perfect gasoline motors, and ran into this wealthy lumber baron, impressed him. That guy put up a ton of money for him to start his first car company. That company failed. That guy then invested a second time for him to start Ford Motor Company, and of course that time, you know, it became the largest company in the world and changed society. But Henry Ford, again, very ambitious, very smart, but out of a pool of a lot of very smart, ambitious people, he was the one who made the right wealthy and powerful friend that kind of made all that possible. Bill Gates was a genius. He also had wealthy parents. But it does a real disservice and kind of gives a false impression of what success looks like. When you leave that part of the story out, it's so much cooler to say, nobody believed in me, you know. It was all the haters told me it couldn't be done.
Gates made his trillions in the tech industry, where every successful company is said to have started in a garage. In actuality, when you look at the major innovations, most of them started the same way great inventions throughout the 20th century started, with a well-funded lab full of the smartest scientists in the world working together to try and solve a bunch of different problems. The story of Apple is told as Steve Jobs tinkering away in his garage. Well, in actuality, in exchange for stock in Apple when they were first starting out in kind of a hot young company in Silicon Valley, he exchanged a bunch of stock for Xerox to let him come in and check out their lab. And then he used a bunch of stuff he saw at their lab, like the mouse, to then build his empire. It's the thing that gets left out is that these accomplishments are built on top of other accomplishments. You had mentioned something that blew my mind about Prince's origin, which for some reason I had just kind of always assumed Purple Rain was at least the shape of his upbringing?
Yeah, because when you watch it, see, this is what's interesting about movies like this and 8 Mile. Like, they're playing someone else, but all of the elements are there to give the hint that this is autobiographical. So in Purple Rain, for the 2 or 3% of our readers who have not watched it in the last month, Prince does not play a man named Prince. He is a young musician in Minneapolis who plays Prince songs and wears purple and rides a purple motorcycle, and everyone else in the movie is using their real name. Like, he's on with the actual Morris Day and the Time. Like, everyone else is playing themselves. But in the movie, his dad is this abusive, crazy asshole, and the whole story is that classic story of, oh, that, you know, he goes and plays music to escape the violence of his home life. And then you look up the real story, and his dad was a somewhat famous professional jazz musician who basically taught Prince music as a toddler. And his dad has, like, song co-writing credits through the 80s, through, like, the Batman soundtrack in 1989. And again, this is not taking anything away from Prince's success, because he's been one of the most prolific artists. I mean, good God, he's been out there since 1982.
Right, but when you think of Prince, you don't think of the amazing tale of a father-son songwriting team. You think of a kind of weirdo loner who made it by the magic of his sexual charisma.
And take any movie, what fictionalized account, whether it's Rudy or Patch Adams, there's always got to be a scene where, like, the establishment is just plainly against you, just inexplicably.
Right.
And when you look at real success stories of real talented people, you always find that pretty early on, they had people recognizing their talent and wanting to jump on board. I mean, again, the guy who gave Henry Ford all that money, he wasn't doing it out of kindness. He was a wealthy investor who knew this was the next big thing, and this guy could get it done. If Henry Ford were here, on top of being very confused by, like, what a podcast is and all that, I think he would say, look, it was because of my drive and my creativity, my determination, that I caught this guy's eye. And again, that's fine, but you have to acknowledge that the ability to catch the eyes of people like that, to meet these people, make a good impression, not burn those bridges, and more importantly, to not have this idea that you can do it alone or that you have to do it alone, that it's always going to be a you against the haters, is a crucial part of success and one of the most important parts beyond hard work, beyond raw talent. The ability to meet people and then not piss them off and to have them want to jump on board and help you and like working with you is huge. But yet when you make 8 Mile, you can't portray that. It's got to be everyone hates Eminem, everyone wrongs Eminem, or whatever his character was called in that movie. He overcomes just through sheer talent until they can't deny it anymore. And it's really, really hard to find a success story that's truly like that. I think people saw Prince playing music at age 12 and knew, oh, okay, this guy's going to be a good musician. Like, it's not difficult to spot it, but if you don't have the parents who are willing to help you along, being able to get people like that on your side is a huge part of success, but you wouldn't know that by watching most biographical or just reading press about successful people and how they got to where they are, because it just, I guess that's not as exciting, or they just want to make themselves look better. But I think you said that there's like a mythology, especially in America, that we want to believe in of the person pulling themselves up by their bootstraps, and that means no help from anybody at any level ever.
Michael and I were talking about why we're obsessed with origin stories, and this one origin story in particular of the orphan. Most Disney characters are orphans. Most of the stars of our favorite childhood cartoons were orphans, even though that's a weird thing to introduce to a children's show, the idea of your parents being dead. Like you said, the real world stories of real world success, you oftentimes just have all the help from their family sort of deleted out of it. There's a sense in which that rhymes with the early story of America. I don't want to do a bullshitty thing where, like, we're all influenced by the origin story of America, and this symbolizes that. The Native American settling of, like, the fact that the continent of America had already been settled, that sort of deleted out of the history of the Pilgrims. Another thing that we've covered on the site is the Boston Massacre, this image that everyone's seen where there's a line of British soldiers just mowing down a handful of unarmed colonial Americans. And in reality, the Boston Massacre was four British soldiers and a mob of armed Americans, but we revise it. From the start, we've always kind of revised the story so it's A, an underdog story, and B, a story where you're kind of coming in and starting from nothing without any help.
Well, and it also gets revised out of history that the Revolutionary War was basically a proxy war between England and France and all of these long-running enemies who kind of saw it as a chance to bloody England's nose. But without the help of France, for instance, that revolution goes nowhere.
Yeah. You know?
And it's so weird, like, the attitude we have toward the French today, because they really made this whole thing happen. That's not to take anything away from the Founding Fathers or the genius that was the Constitution and everything that they did right, which obviously created the greatest superpower of the last God knows how many centuries. But that's the thing. It's this black and white thing where if you acknowledge that it couldn't have been done without help, it's the same as saying that it was worthless. It's the same as calling them all, you know, Paris Hilton. They're just worthless heirs of somebody else's hard work, and that's not true. You need both. You need to have help. But, like, you mentioned all of our fictional stories that kind of mimic this. There's another element. The mentor character always has to die. You know, Obi-Wan Kenobi has to die. Dumbledore has to die. You know, even Gandalf has to die, even though, you know, Tolkien brought him back. That person, it's always the same framework of the person who helps you, but then they've got to die off, and you've got to be able to say legitimately, I did it completely by myself. Because if Obi-Wan is there to help you through the very end, well, then that cheapens it somehow. And that's crazy. It's so desperate to devalue, you know, the role of a support system in accomplishing anything worthwhile, that even now I can, like, feel myself rebelling against it. And I'll come clean right now. I told you a story one time about when I was a youth in Hong Kong and had mastered the martial art of Wing Chun. I had gotten into a fight with about 50 Kung Fu masters that had, you remember, they had cornered me in a skyscraper. It was like half finished and we were fighting on the girders.
Yeah, this was the deal closer in your job interview.
Yeah, and then, because you had asked me to name a project that I had headed up on a deadline, and this was the story I told.
Sure.
So finally, like, I had met their master out on a crane kind of dangling over the city, and I had drop-kicked him off, and that's how I won the fight. Now, notice what I left out of that tale. Without the training of my master teaching me the art of Wing Chun, I probably don't defeat more than 30 of those men. Like, if I'm just relying on my human strength and reflexes, it probably, you know, probably three quarters of the way through that fight, somebody takes me down. But yet I tell that story and I make it sound like it was, oh, me. But it wasn't. If he hadn't taught me, then maybe if I'm the one getting kicked off that crane at the end.
I think anyone who's seen you fight knows that you're practicing false modesty here. I want to go back to sort of this idea that it's not that these people lie so much as we desperately need these things to be true, but we have an amazing ability to seek out the detail that makes the story what we need it to be and just kind of blow that up and delete everything else that kind of disproves that.
Well, I'll tell you right now, if you gave me, if somehow I had been alive in 1983 or whenever they were making Purple Rain, if you'd give me that screenplay and had the real story in there, like Prince and his supportive father, like the first thing I do, the first revision I make is to make his home life a wreck. Because you need tension. If that's not in the movie, it's a boring movie. And if you're writing your autobiography, even though it's supposed to be factual, I think the exact same thing comes into play. I think all of us are natural storytellers. I don't care if you've never written a short story or a screenplay in your life. You've been at the bar and told a funny story and made everybody. You have instincts for how to get their attention or make them laugh or whatever. And I think if you sit down to write your own life story, you'll try to remember to mention the people who helped you because you don't want them to be mad. But very quickly, you're going to keep dropping all these times when you were rejected and told no or whatever. And I think that they think they're making the story more inspirational, but what they're correctly thinking is that nobody will read it otherwise. It's not an exciting origin story. But it has outright built a false idea of what success looks like. And you've mentioned in the past the whole concept of risk-taking. In order to play up the drama, it has to really sound like, this was a Hail Mary shot. That's the thing that I think Americans love, is the idea of, we bet it all on one big spin of the wheel, and either it was going to come through or else we were going to wind up dead in a ditch somewhere. So when you hear somebody say, well, Bill Gates dropped out of college to start a business and hope that it would become this computer thing would take off, it sounds like he was taking a massive risk there. If our friends had done that, if that fails, they're going to wind up sleeping in their car with a bunch of student loan debt. That was not Bill Gates' situation. If Microsoft had failed, then he would just go back to school and take some other very prominent job as a software engineer or doing whatever.
He did not drop out of college either. He left college because it was too primitive for him. He had grown up with the most programming training of anyone in America, and being on the East Coast, there just wasn't, Harvard did not have what he needed. It was too far beneath him. That's why he left Harvard. It was, a calculated decision to kind of go in the direction that was going to make him money.
Yeah, and just to give some context for that, that sounds absurd to say now, but people have to understand Bill Gates grew up at a time and went to middle school and high school at a time when having access to a mainframe, like a networked computer, was like having access to a helicopter. This was the 1960s. So, for instance, his parents put him into a high-end prep school that happened to be like one of three schools in the country that had access to a mainframe that he could tinker around with. So right off the bat, he has an advantage that very, very, very few people have. It's not that this is a substitute for genius and hard work, is that it gave the genius and hard work a chance to function because he had that margin for error, the same as Henry Ford had margin for error, when you had these backers who are basically backing, that if this doesn't work out, I'm still right where I am, or I've got other avenues open to me. If you see some wealthy person go and give a talk at a high school and he talks to all these poor kids about, you got to be willing to take risks, you got to be willing to put it all on the line, that's the only way it's going to pay off. And it's much, much easier for somebody with two wealthy parents to put everything on the line, knowing that at worst, you have to move back home, versus somebody who maybe is the son of a single mom who's got three other kids living at home and who now doesn't have a bedroom anymore, who knows that if he puts everything on the line and busts out, he's literally sleeping in his car or, doing something illegal. Like, there's no more options left. The difference between gambling with your own money or gambling with somebody else's money is huge. In order to get a seat at the table, you've got to have some chips to play. And if you don't have that, and if somebody doesn't kick a few in, then it's a little bit dickish to just keep telling them, got to go out there and take risks. It's like, yeah, but you've got something to gamble with.
Yeah. there's been plenty of studies that indicate that actually what you said is exactly right. Business people who are really successful businessmen, for instance, Malcolm Gladwell wrote this article about Ted Turner, who is known as the risk-taking, you know, crazy, by-the-seat-of-his-pants businessman who, like, risked it all and made his money, you know, in the classic way that we like to think of money being made, at the table, betting it all. The thing that this book that Gladwell was reviewing found is that the one thing that all these, the Sam Waltons and Ted Turners and these entrepreneurs who make, who have just obscene success, that we all use as sort of our model for how to find success, when you actually look at their story, that they all have in common is that they're extremely risk averse. Extremely risk averse. They wait for a sure thing, a bet that they know the odds are in their favor, and then they keep betting on that over and over and over until other people catch on, and hopefully by that time they're billionaires. The story of how to become a really successful person in America is rarely interesting. It's one of looking for the smartest, safest situation. There's an entire shelf at your local bookstore, or there was when there were local bookstores, dedicated to CEOs who made millions and then told their story, and not a single one of them offers that advice, that you basically wait for a sucker to come along who doesn't understand the value of a certain bet and just wager an enormous amount of money on that. Not your own, because that's too risky.
Yeah, and I think that if you go to poor neighborhoods or poor parts of the country, like, depending on where you are, every kid has a different incorrect idea of what it takes to become rich. Watching 8 Mile, the whole thing is like, I'll become a superstar or else I'll wind up dead. And that's literally in the lyrics to the theme song of that movie, which I'm going to go ahead and rap the whole thing right now.
Perfect.
Okay, and don't edit that out from the podcast, because that was one of the best renditions I've ever done of that. But it literally says, this is my one shot. Like, success is my only option, my one chance I get. And that is absolutely not the way it works. That makes the most drama. That is a horrible way to run a business or a life. And no successful business does do it that way. No good NFL team puts everything into a Hail Mary. You've got all sorts of ways you mitigate risks, and if this receiver isn't open, you've got another guy to check down to. And it's kind of the difference between the people who took those bets and had them pay off. It's very, very easy for them to come back 20 years later and say, see, this is what you need to do. You need to quit your job working as a nurse and go open a business in your garage. And I think most of the talented people I've known or have been tangentially connected to, they knew pretty early that they were talented and got good feedback pretty early. You know, they won the talent show in grade school, or they had, you know, parents that were taking them to lessons or things like that. If you've got somebody who by age 19 or 20 has the confidence to, whatever, go up on stage at a stand-up comedy joint or to sit down with a group of investors and convince them to put money into their business, if you've reached that point with that kind of confidence, you've done it because you've gotten some affirmation along the way. Like, somebody believed in you.
Right.
And so the role of having that, and I know that people call out a problem in our society, everybody gets a trophy now. People complain about that as pampering kids, giving them a false self-esteem or whatever. But the bigger problem is there's a process by which you discover what you're good at, what you're really good at, and what you only thought you were good at. And so with the people who actually are able to turn some talent into a career, they have that. They've had an environment where they've been able to learn, no, I'm actually really good at whatever, coding software, painting pictures, whatever the thing is you're going to turn into a career. And when that becomes apparent, there's usually people around you who want to be involved because most people are eager to do that. They're eager to take you to the lessons. They're eager to see what you can do. And I think the real tragedy, if there is in a lot of, you know, socioeconomic strata or parts of the country where you can have a really talented kid, but that's there's no possible way for them to get that kind of, you know what, we're going to pay for you to take these extra lessons. We're going to buy you a freaking guitar. We're going to do all these things that require an investment.
Right. I've been thinking a lot about Kanye West versus Jay-Z and LeBron James versus Michael Jordan. Jordan and Jay-Z are both great at self-mythologizing. In Jay-Z's case, every album he's ever released includes him talking about how he started as a drug dealer, he didn't have help, outsmarted the cops to get there. Michael Jordan's famous origin story that he got cut from his high school team isn't true. He got cut as a, I think, freshman or sophomore. He didn't make varsity. He had to play on and dominate junior varsity. They're the superheroes of our generation, or at least very recent generations, because they had these, they were able to tell these archetypal stories. Now, Kanye West just talks about how he had a great mom, he worked his ass off. He has one song where he talks about how he stayed inside his apartment one summer making beats until 3 a.m. every morning because he wanted it so bad. That is not what we want to hear, and I feel like that's why he has taken on this sort of villain role in the national media. And then with LeBron, I find his origin story way more fascinating than any of those people because he basically grew up inside the Truman Show, right? When he was in high school, Adidas and Nike were putting ads on the bus aimed specifically at LeBron, trying to convince him to sign with them. Adidas put one on the Akron public buses that said, "What are you going to do with international celebrity?" The fact that he had such high expectations, was so inundated with this idea that he was going to be the best player ever and became one of the best players ever is crazy and something that we can't tolerate, I don't think, in a superstar. The decision was off-putting, certainly, but there's still a surprising amount of hatred for him out there, and I wonder if that's not because he can't fit into this sort of archetypal origin story we want to tell. Whereas, like, over in Europe, Messi, the great soccer player, they've known about him since he was, like, 12. He was supposed to be the greatest. He was, and everybody loves him for it. But I feel like we need that in order for someone to be the superhero, and otherwise we kind of turn them into the villain.
Yeah, in other words, because we have a more accurate picture of success with LeBron and Kanye, we hate them.
Exactly.
Because, like, well, he had every advantage possible. Why are we rooting for him? Because we can't grasp that that's true of virtually everyone who became successful. They had advantages along the way. But think about how harmful the fake version of the Michael Jordan story is. Because it says to every kid out there, you can be as talented as Michael Jordan and somehow the world won't see it, which is ludicrous. I mean, I'm trying to picture a high school coach with a 16-year-old Michael Jordan who can jump over the backboard, but isn't a great outside shooter. And like,
well, he was
get this kid off my team. Was he not also a fantastic, like, Little League baseball player?
Yeah, absolutely. He was probably the greatest athlete in North Carolina in his age group, right? But
yeah,
that doesn't...
Yeah, and had been hearing that since probably age 8.
Right.
Coaches are not shy. Like, you have a superstar 10-year-old on your team, you get excited the same as if you're an NFL coach and you've got a superstar quarterback. Michael Jordan was hearing that he was a potential superstar from a very, very young age. Eminem was hearing that he was pretty good at rapping from, like, the first couple of months he tried it. He clearly was a talent. The idea that any of these people could have existed in an environment where everybody was just telling them, "Ah, bag it up, you know, go, work in a grocery store, Michael Jordan, you can't play defense good enough to make it." And they're like, "Oh, I'll show them, I'm going to overcome these odds." If you knew in reality how much support he got, how many compliments he got, how much attention he got, you would probably hate him. And likewise, most of your heroes, if you knew how popular they were, how much emotional support they got, how much ego support they got, self-esteem support you got, you would probably hate them because it doesn't compare to your life. And I know that's not the case in 100% of the situations, but and I know there's other cases where people had a lot of talent but had other things that held them back until late in their career and they finally woke up. But usually you find that along the way, while they were failing, they had other people trying to tell them, look, you're capable of more.
All right, that was my interview with David Wong, a.k.a. Jason Pargin. And since we had that conversation, I've just noticed this story structure everywhere. You know, the story of Einstein flunking math is a myth that you probably heard. He didn't. He had mastered differential calculus. There's a quote where he responds to that myth by being like, no, I had pretty much mastered math by the time I was 13 years old. But it's that same thing, wanting to make Einstein into this everyman who had to overcome the odds of his math-fogged brain. The new Drake album, by the way, on which he has the balls to say he started from the bottom, even though he probably had an agent before he got to high school. He was a famous child actor at age 13. But we'll get to that in a minute in the footnotes. The Disney orphan thing was sort of rushed past, so just to touch on that again quickly, Disney made every cartoon character you grew up on an orphan. Think about Cinderella, Snow White, Aladdin, Peter Pan, Simba, we actually see him be orphaned. Disney knew that we would rather contemplate the death of our own parents than root for a character who had a family, because they knew the story structure of the very specific lie we like to tell ourselves. They knew you needed victory against all odds. You can't be the favorite or even have the advantage of a good family or even talent, I guess, is what we covered with the LeBron thing. We don't want our heroes to have talent. We want them to have to overcome a lack of talent, like Michael Jordan supposedly did, even though he didn't. It really has to be just sheer tyranny of will and risk-taking. And then everybody has to have not believed in you. And then the second part is obviously me against the world. Nobody believed in me. They told me I couldn't do it. And we're going to keep talking about those two rules in footnotes because the song we opened with is called All Me. And it's the second song Drake released off his new album, Nothing Was the Same. If you've seen that, it's the new Drake album where you've got the profile of Drake on the cover, and then on the back cover is a profile of, I guess, baby Drake, and he's facing himself. So it's really a concept album about Drake's origin story, which is really ballsy because he was a child actor, as everybody knows. But the album is really an amazing testament to self-mythologizing. The first song released off the album all the way back in February goes like this.
Start it. Started from the bottom, now we're here. Started from the bottom, now my whole.
And this one is called All Me.
Came up, that's all me. Stay true, that's all me. No help, that's all me. All me.
Just saying that he came all the way from the bottom and it was all him, no advantages, no help from anyone else. You just sort of have to admire the shrewdness. Drake knows the rules of the story we want to hear as well as Disney, and he's one of the most popular recording artists in the world for a reason. You also heard a really smart song about the way we mythologize the past called Nostalgia. Smart song with a really stupid title, but it's by Pusha T, features Kendrick Lamar, who I know we've been talking about a lot lately, with good reason. He's amazing. So the first verse of this song opens with the standard cocaine rap from Pusha, and then it ends with Kendrick Lamar rapping about his dad being a victim of the 80s crack epidemic. So it's not just using nostalgia, it's actually about nostalgia and the way that it sometimes doesn't tell the whole truth about how the past actually went down. We like this idea of Jay-Z, and even with Breaking Bad just ending, Walter White as drug kingpins, self-made men. But you know, as Walter White was fading away in that last episode of Breaking Bad, they never showed that there's consequences to that. There's a 15-year-old kid somewhere with his teeth falling out of his head because he's addicted to the amazing meth that Walter White cooked up. And so that's why this new Pusha T song is better than the final episode of Breaking Bad. Come at me, Breaking Bad fans. Okay, that's it for this episode. We'll see you next week. Y'all was smoking, it's my profession. Let's get it. They must be on the dick of who? They must be on the dick of who? This has been an Earwolf Media production. Executive producers Jeff Ulrich and Scott Aukerman. For more information, visit earwolf.com.
Earwolf Radio, boom.com. The wolf dead.